Hey everyone, welcome back to Milkshakes Pod. This is the first episode of season two, first episode of 2024. In this episode, we talk about a number of the macro data that has been introduced for the first 2 weeks of 2024.
Yeah, and what we then do is talk about how that data plays into this year's Magnificent Seven. So if you want to find out what those seven things are, you're going to have to tune into the show.
And Brent also does a wonderful job of sharing some of his mindset on a new year and just managing money overall. So if you want to get past some of the deep details and get more into the head of Mr. Brent Johnson, this episode is for you.
40,500,000 all in.
Raise all in.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It is 2024. This is the first episode of the Milkshakes Pod for the new year and our new season number two. My name is John Kutzmita. This is Brent Johnson. If you're new to the show, please head on over to the YouTube channel where we got everything laid out there for you in playlists and segments and all kinds of good stuff. It's been a couple weeks, Brent, since we've chatted. We've been getting a lot of love from the Milkshakes fam saying they're excited to hear from us. They're anxious. Well, we're coming back. We're bringing the noise. This is our full length episode. I think we have some other things and ideas that we'll be sharing hopefully sometime this quarter. But let's just get back into the swing of things like we were doing all last year and talk about the market. But before we do that, is there anything about your break that you had, the end of the year or heading into this year that you want to start us off with?
No, I had a great Christmas break. Went back to California for a few weeks. I hadn't been back there for a few years, and I enjoyed myself. It was great. I mean, California is an amazing place if you can just get rid of all the politicians. So from that perspective, it was good to be back and see family. And, you know, I'm excited for 2024. I'm ready to go.
So we had a number of segments that we toyed with last year. One of them was the Madness Edition, where we kind of just went off the cuff, random topics. We did a good chunk of one of those episodes was on pickleball. Didn't you have a bit of a pickleball incident in California?
No, I didn't personally have one, but there was one where there was a lady that literally had, she was living next to these public pickleball courts and it was driving her crazy. And she lives right next to this park, which is called the Presidio. And it's kind of it's a beautiful piece of property. But there's some environmental lands there. So what she did is she goes and gets an environmental lawyer to say that all these pickleball players are endangering the habitat and the animals and the native grasses and all this ridiculous stuff. Right. And so then of course it turns out that, in her backyard, she has a pickleball court. Someone went on the Google Earth or whatever and zoomed in on her property. And of course she's got one herself. So, you know, it's just typical California, not in my backyard stuff.
Not my backyard. And she was also trying to sell the property too, wasn't she?
Oh yeah. The house was, yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, look, let's see what's going on in our backyard. We did not, for the first not complete week of 2024, we didn't do a recording. We just wrapped up the first full trading week of 2024. But in the previous week, probably the most notable thing that we might want to touch on as we get going here is the non-farm payrolls. Was there anything in that data set that, you know, changed your view last year? Or perhaps in addition to getting some insight into what you thought was going on with non-farm payroll, do you kind of want to give us what your take is on how the year is going to unfold before we get into some of the other economic data?
Well, I think the best way to say it is it continues to contribute to this contradictory mindset that I think people have. And we're going to get into, you know, the potential rate cuts and, you know, the soft landing or the no landing or the immaculate landing or whatever kind of landing we're going to talk about. And that the number, you know, it came in slightly hawkish, but when you dig into it underneath, it wasn't great, right? And then same thing with when CPI came in, you know, this week, it came in, you know, kind of a little bit dovish, but not super dovish. And so all these numbers, you know, they're kind of coming in line. And what I kind of found interesting was, you know, November, December, everything, it seemed to come in hawkish, but things reacted dovishly. And now so far this year, things have kind of come in dovishly, but yet markets have sort of reactive hawkishly. If, you know, in other words, you know, markets ended on a high last year, everything was up, And we talked about this towards the end of last year, how everything is right back where it was 2 years ago at this time. It's kind of amazing. Yet interest rates have reset from 0 to 5.5%. But now this month, the month to date, I think markets are flat to down a little bit. They were down in the first week. They were up this last week. And I think they're kind of flat to down slightly for the year. We're only 2 weeks into it, but I notice a change in that. Whereas 2 or 3 months ago, this data that was coming in slightly dovishly, I think would have rocketed the market higher. And now I feel like the market's in a tug of war to where it's positioned for and where it wants to go. But more nerves are showing up now than they were in, you know, late Q4. So, you know, I think as we go forward, I don't think it's going to be a smooth ride this year at all.
At what point would you start to change your mind on that? Is there a particular set of data or things that you're looking at? Because I think last year you were pretty open-minded, but you definitely had reasons for the narrative that you thought it would be a weaker year than it was. And a lot of yes. that seemed to be the markets front-running the Fed. And so if markets are efficient, all this stuff gets priced in. It's you know, buy the rumor, sell the fact. And now we're at the point where, can markets really go any higher? The Fed is basically paused. Anything left is a pivot and or this magnificent yep. seven rate cuts.
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to say is I should have been more bullish last year than I was. I understood why the market could go higher, and it did, and we made money, but we certainly could have made them a lot more than we did. And I was, in hindsight, I was too concerned with the market front running the rate cuts. And rather than be concerned about it, as of today, I should have been less concerned and tried to participate more. Now we'll see, you know, 2 or 3 months from now, whether that's still the case. But I think that's where we're at now is we were, first of all, and then the second thing, so that's the first thing is I was too bearish last year. I fully admit that. But I think, you know, it's important to remember that you can believe things are going to get worse, but still be positioned to make money if it doesn't get worse. And that's where, you know, the hedges that we had, you know, we talked about that a number of times throughout the year. They didn't pay off. It turns out we didn't need the hedges, but the other long positions that we had did very well. And so the hedges were a drag, but they didn't kill us. But going forward this year, I'll say regarding this year is markets can definitely go higher. So anybody who is saying that it can't possibly go any higher, of course it can. You know, this is the classic, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay liquid. So I can paint a few scenarios where markets will go higher. That said, you know, we started to talk about this at the end of last year. Market positioning and sentiment now is the polar opposite, or at least 2 weeks ago and last week, it was the polar opposite of where it was at the end of 2022, first week of 2023. You know, the put call ratio, the sentiment, the positioning, everything is flipped from a year ago. So whereas last year, kind of the short covering and the sentiment and all that stuff contributed to the markets going higher, that is flipped now. So it doesn't mean that the market can't go higher, but it's got its work cut out for it. And I personally feel like the market is kind of priced to perfection. Now, it doesn't mean that it can't stay perfect and it can't continue to trend higher. It absolutely can. But I'm not sure what the additional new catalyst is that really rockets things higher to take it past what's already priced in. And I think as we go forward, the data, you know, the central banker comments, the Fed meetings, I think that's going to be a big factor. But I think the biggest factor that I feel like people are probably overlooking is that they're too focused on the Fed and not focused enough on China, Japan, and Europe. Because I feel like while there's certainly risks, you know, that could jump out of nowhere in the United States, there are even more risks overseas. And it's kind of amazing that we've been able to go the last 4 years since COVID without having any kind of a crisis that kind of, a few things popped up here and there, but there was never any contagion that kind of got away and kind of spread. And I feel like, you know, the further we go down the road, the more likely those things pop up again. And the more likely is it that, that it's contagious as opposed to contained.
Look, there's a lot of deja vu, for me at least, kicking off this year. I mean, as you mentioned, one of the final episodes we did last year was titled The Great Reset. And that was kind of tongue in cheek because you had shown data points and data sets where we basically did a full circle over a 2 year period. Well, I remember going into last year this time, and many of the narratives, particularly with the Ukraine war and a lot of other geopolitical stuff that was going on, and certainly domestic monetary policy, what the Fed was potentially going to continue doing as far as rate cuts or rate pauses, I feel like I'm seeing the same stuff, particularly from the energy bulls. But, you know, there's growing tensions in the Middle East. You know, the Israel-Gaza situation seems to be spilling over into the Red Sea, into Yemen. It feels like, you know, the NATO and similar allies are getting pulled into that. So it feels like the Ukraine situation again, which gets all of the energy bulls excited because, you know, this is going to make oil go through the moon. And now the new narrative is we're finally going to have that polar vortex and it's going to be freezing cold. So, you know, Europe is going to be frozen to death because they've gone green and gone woke. So a lot of these narratives are resurfacing. When you're going into this year, kind of reflecting on something you just said there, where, you know, many times last year we've reminded people it's a relative game. And although the arguments are valid that are being made against the U.S. monetary policy, the credit situation, the exploding deficits, it's not like anywhere else or everywhere else is, you know, a walk in the park. So you bring that up again. At what point, bringing these two points together, at what point or how do you go into a new year, even on a weekly basis, and question some of your own narratives and say, okay, I keep, you know, positioning this as a relative game, but what is going on in the U.S. that perhaps I'm missing? And when these other market participants who are in the energy sector or whatever it is, when they're getting high on their horse with their narratives and why they think they're so right, because everything just seems like a perfect storm, is there perhaps a methodology or mental practice that they can approach their game with that make them a little sharper?
Well, for me, what I do, and I'll give specific examples, and I think I even touched on this at some point on one of the episodes last year, was that for a long time, especially earlier in my career, it's funny, everybody always wants to be right. Everybody always wants to appear smart. Nobody ever, and especially when you're young, nobody ever wants to say, I don't know, because you don't want to appear to not be either professional or smart or have a knowledge of what's going on. And so when I was younger, people are going to laugh at this. They're going to say, wow, you were even cockier then than you are now. But, you know, when I was younger, I probably made a lot more predictions and was more sure about them than I am now. And what I certainly have, you know, conviction on things, and I certainly have confidence, but I don't have certainty on anything. And that is the one thing that I will pound the table on, is nothing is certain. There's nothing that I say there's certain. There's nothing that Stanley Druckenmiller says that is certain. There's nothing that John Cutsmeta says that's certain. And there's nothing that my mom says is certain, right? So, you know, I have tremendous respect for all these people, but it doesn't mean I necessarily believe everything they tell me. And nobody should believe everything Brent Johnson says either, because Brent doesn't know, right? But one thing is, I stopped being sure about everything and trying to be right about everything and just tried to be prepared for everything. And so that's where someone said this a long time ago. It's kind of a famous saying. And somebody said it to me a long time ago, and I probably didn't really believe it when I first heard it. But the older I've gotten, the more I know that it's true, is that the key to being successful, either, you know, in this business, in the business that I am, or as an investor, is to make a lot of money when you're right and not get killed when you're wrong. right? And so it doesn't, and sometimes you can even make money when you're wrong. Like I'd say last year is a good example. Like we made some money last year, and you know, I didn't make as much as the S&P 500. I wish I would have, but you know, I didn't, but you know, we still made money. And you know, but I was, I've, you know, fully admit that I didn't get last year right. And so, and that's a good example of the tack that I've taken. And the reason is that if you look over the arc of history, assets tend to go up and to the right. Part of that is because of, you know, human ingenuity and technological innovation. Part of it is because fiat currencies lose value over time, but you know, assets tend to go up and to the right. So if you're in the investment business, you need to, for the most part, be long those assets, right? And that's the idea. But then once you understand that the design of the system means that there's going to be shocks along the way, you can't just be long only and never think about it. At least I don't think you can. So I've developed a methodology that lets me participate in the long side. If I'm wrong, I'm still okay. And if I'm right and things go bad, I'm not wiped out, so to speak. And so I would say that that's what I would say to some of these other people that have these narratives is I love narratives. I think storytelling is a lost art. And I think narratives are very powerful. So if you're trying to get a point of view across to people, if you can come up with a story to kind of explain it, I think that's a fantastic way to do it. I think you just have to understand that your story might not come true, right? and take measures to be prepared in case your story doesn't come true. And I think that so whereas the last year and this year, I would say, I think we're going to have higher volatility. I thought we were going to have higher volatility last year. I think we're going to have higher volatility this year. I know I can be wrong, so I'm positioned in the way that if I'm wrong, we'll be okay. But I'm also positioned in a way that if I'm right, we're not going to get wiped out. So it's a little bit opposite of what I was saying before, but it's the same concept is that, and I think everybody should do that. I don't think anybody should go all in on one thing. Or if you do go all in on one thing, you have to really understand the consequences of being wrong. So if anybody does go all in on something, they have that much conviction. Listen, I have respect for it. I have total respect for it. And, you know, I think it was Paul Tudor Jones said one time, never trust anybody who hasn't ever bet at all at one point. And, you know, I think there's some legitimacy to that. At some point, you just got to put it all on the line and go with your convictions. But if you're trying to protect a portfolio and grow it over long periods of time, unless your specific goal in life is to beat the S&P 500 every year, there's no reason you have to take that much risk, or there's no reason you have to position your portfolio in a way to always do that. And so I would, for anybody who's managing a portfolio or trying to figure out how to navigate this storm, again, rather than trying to figure out what's going to happen and being 100% right, just try to be prepared for anything that could happen and live to fight another day.
Well, look, it's early in the year. There certainly have been some interesting data points, the non-farm payroll, the CPI inflation data. I'm kind of leaning into this conversation we're having because I feel like it's like you got to get your house in order before you really start trying to battle through a year when volatility kicks up and there's all this action going on that can get you dragged one way or the other. So I think it was very insightful what you shared. I'd like to kind of pull on that string a little bit more. So one, for you as an asset manager, anyone who's involved in the market's going to see all these things happening. There's tons of narratives. There's tons of chatter and talk. People, you know, bragging when they get the 1 out of 10 thing right. And so FOMO can kind of kick in. We've talked about that before. Now, as someone who's managing other people's wealth and assets, you have to have these conversations, right? Like, hey, Brent, I see the S&P doing XYZ. We're lagging it. And so not only are you fighting your own internal voice, but you're also potentially fighting or having to hold your ground with clients who maybe are feeling that FOMO. So for those people out there watching this who, you know, maybe not have an asset manager and they're just trying to, you know, keep their hands steady, what's kind of the approach that you have in those types of conversations so that maybe people can have that same conversation in their head?
Well, for if there's one thing I've done right in my career, I think is, and that is I've always managed expectations with clients of what is possible, what is not possible. You know, what level of risk you will have to, if you want me to get a certain level of return, this is the level of risk you will have to take. And this is the level of pain you are going to feel if it doesn't work out. So I think I've done a good job of managing expectations of what is possible. And then I think I've done a good job of just being honest when things worked and being honest when things haven't worked. And that's the thing. What I will often say in a very first meeting or even subsequent meetings with either potential clients or clients is the only guarantee I can make to you is that at some point along the way, I am going to lose money for you. Other than that, no guarantees. Because you're at some point, nobody is always going to be right about everything. And the other thing is that I'm a big believer in diversification. I don't think diversification alone is the answer, but I'm a big believer in diversification. And so one thing I say to people is whenever we do a review, we should be asking where have we made money? And if the answer if the answer is nowhere, then that's a problem, right? And the second question should be where are we losing money? And if the answer is nowhere, that's also a problem. Because if you're making money in every single part of your portfolio, then you are not truly diversified. You may be diversified by security or asset class, but you're not diversified by risk level, and you're not diversified by how these assets will react in some kind of an adverse scenario. And so, you know, that helps. Having that as the foundation of the way I manage money and communicate to clients, that helps. Now, that said, you know, with that as the qualifier, yeah, when everybody wants to beat the S&P 500. And so in years where you trail, you get the questions and sometimes you get hard questions and sometimes people aren't happy. And, you know, you at that point, you have to choose whether you're going to become a yes man and do what they ask you to just to get them off your back, or whether you're going to stand your ground. And you know, sometimes it's a little bit of a dance there as well. You know, I will, if there is a time where people want to do something that I don't think that they do, I will tell them, listen, I don't recommend this, but if you want me to do it, I will do it. Because at the end of the day, it's their money. They're the CEO. I'm the CFO. I give them advice, but at the end of the day, it's their money. And I learned that a long time ago, is that it is their money. You know, I can guide them, I can give them advice, I can tell them what I think they should do, but at the end of the day, it's their money. And if they want to do it a certain way, then that's what I do. And this goes a little bit back to what we talked about at one point last year as well, is that, you know, not being a financial justice warrior. If I feel a certain way about a market or a political system or a monetary system, I should not impose my morals or my way of looking at the world on somebody else's capital. And if they feel the same way, then maybe so. But I shouldn't automatically assume that, as an example, I shouldn't automatically assume that my clients want the fiat system to come down and move to a gold standard, because maybe they don't, right? Maybe they're perfectly happy with the way it is. And so I should not necessarily position their whole portfolio in a way that would benefit from the fiat currency system crashing and gold rising, because that's not being a fiduciary. Me telling them they should have a portion of their portfolio allocated to such a thing and them agreeing to do so, and me pointing out all the risks of why that could happen and why it would be important to own gold, that is different than on my own using my discretion to put 100% of their portfolio in gold when that is not necessarily something that they want to do. Not sure quite how we got on that topic, but that's my answer.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I think it's a tricky thing. Managing your own views combined with individuals' risk profiles, expectations, more than anything, probably their source of news. You know, when you're in the service-based business and it's financially related, people can be getting all kinds of crappy information. Certainly hyperbolic information. It feels like that's the only thing that's out there anymore. And then they're coming to you being like, oh, we got to do this. I saw so-and-so on this channel. And
that's a little bit, you know, honestly, a lot of my client talks with my clients are very similar to these talks here. Is I spend a lot of time explaining. I spend a lot of time teaching. I spend a lot of time, you know, giving different scenarios. So as an, I'm just going to make up a conversation because it hasn't happened. But let's say last week I had a client review and they said, you know, the S&P was up 22% last year and the NASDAQ was up 50. You know, how come we didn't beat those? Well, one of the first things I would say was, number one, I didn't think they were going to be up that much. So I'll take responsibility for that. Number two, the risk level that had to be taken to get those returns was rather high. And based on our previous conversations, you know, you indicated that you didn't want to take those levels of risk. And then the third thing I would say is, while the S&P was up 22%, you know, 90% of that 20% is the result of seven stocks. And, you know, those seven stocks went up a tremendous amount. The other 493 went up 7 or 8%, right? And so, you know, if you want to have the concentration and the risk profile of owning seven technology stocks or whatever, you know, then we have to have a conversation regarding the overall portfolio and your overall risk level rather than, you know, the way that it's set up now. So that's a lot, setting things up appropriately, managing expectations at the beginning, and then you kind of educating and making sure they have the correct information going on is also a big part of it.
All very good information. So we've been kind of skirting in and out of a couple different things, more of a broad discussion here, but you did mention the Magnificent Seven, you know, these seven stocks that pretty much drove most of the returns in equities last year. What's your new Magnificent Seven for 2024?
Well, I think if we get seven rate cuts, that would be the Magnificent Seven. That would be the most magnificent seven that I have probably ever seen. And this is where I think market participants have this wrong, and where they have this cognitive dissonance, is where they have contradictory thinking. And what I mean by that is, the market is now pricing in, I think, seven rate cuts through the end of 2024, if I have that right. I know they're pricing in seven rate cuts. I can't remember for sure if it's in 2024 or if it's, that's what they have it like in the next, you know, 15 months or whatever it is, but seven rate cuts are priced in. And the only time in history that if they did 25 basis points each time, that's like 1.5 to 2%, you know, cut in rates. Not impossible, but that's a lot, right? And there's only three times in history, I think, where that happened within a 12-month period. One of them was like back in the 60s or something, and it was the result, and it was in response to a crisis. It might have been in response to like the oil embargo in the early 70s. I have to go back and look and see which one that one was. But the other one was in the early 80s, you know, when Volcker had taken interest rates to like 19 or 20% and just kind of slammed the economy. And when they started to ease off that super tight monetary policy, you know, they dropped interest rates that much seven times or 1.5 to 2% or whatever it was. But that's coming off at an extreme high interest rates right now. Interest rates are high now relative to where they have been for the last decade. But in general terms, interest rate are not super high historically. So the point is for the Fed to cut seven times, in my opinion, it's going to take a significant event that forces them to do that. Now, in other words, they're not just going to come out and for the hell of it, out of the blue, cut seven times. And if the market keeps going higher, they're not going to cut seven times. What would cause them to cut seven times would be if the market or if the economy continues to slow down, these inflation prints, the GDP prints, the non-farm payroll numbers come in soft. And if they come in soft and show that the economy is slowing, then they may have to cut rates in order to keep the economy from slowing too much. And if the market really turned down and then the stock market followed, you know, something like, you know, 2020 or, you know, the fourth quarter of 2018 or the global financial crisis. In other words, if they are cutting dramatically in order to counter a deflationary move, stock prices are probably falling in that scenario, right? And so that's why, and let's take the reverse case. If stock prices are not falling and inflation prints aren't coming in weaker and non-farm payroll numbers aren't coming in lower, then why on earth would they cut seven times? So again, I think by front running the cuts, it's keeping the cuts from happening, or it's going to cause things to fall off a cliff because they've run to this precipice, and then markets are going to fall off a cliff, forcing the seven rate cuts. Now that's possible, but in that case, you don't necessarily want to be in risk assets right now because it's going to be the falling of risk assets that then necessitates the falling of interest rates. And that's where I think people, and that's why I think the idea that we're going to get seven rate cuts, I think it's wrong. So if they materialize, that'll be my magnificent seven. But I could see them. I could see some dramatic cuts if markets turn down.
What'd be interesting, maybe on a subsequent episode here, is to look at some of these market factors that are being priced in at different times in history and what was the underlying result. Like, how many times has Fed funds futures priced in four rate hikes and eight happened? Or how many times have they priced seven cuts and three happened? Because it does feel like and just markets, they just have this Greenspan saying of irrational exuberance. That just always, the pendulum just always seems to swing too far. And then we find ourselves somewhere in the middle. Last year was definitely an interesting one in the regards to the fact that everyone was in the beginning of the year, very bearish. And then we kind of had this momentum. And then everyone was like, okay, well, it's been a pretty good year. This eventually is going to pull back. And then it just kept going. So last year definitely felt like one of those years where it was just catching everybody off sides. There wasn't really an equilibrium going on.
Yeah. And so, I kind of feel like this year could potentially be similar to 2022 in that, I think people thought they were going to raise rates in 2022, but nobody expected them to raise them as much as they did. So, the market was expecting, the monetary policy to be tighter, but not as tight as it was. And so this year, I feel like everybody's expecting it to ease, but I don't think it's going to ease as much as they're expecting it to. I don't think the Fed's going to raise anymore. I mean, the Fed has very clearly pivoted. Now, it's possible that if inflation prints start to come in hawkish again and non-farm payrolls stay strong, maybe they have to repivot and start raising again. But there is no question in my mind that, at least from a mental perspective, Powell has pivoted. Whether the market, continues to weaken and he is able to cut rates, and kind of bring in this smooth, soft landing, that's another question. But in my mind, he at least mentally has shifted towards, we are no longer tightening and we're on the glide path to lowering rates. I just think, and it's funny because in the fourth quarter, several times I said Powell has done a good job. I don't necessarily love central bankers and I don't necessarily agree with all the monetary policy, but listen, he's accomplished his goals. And then I always said, I don't think ultimately he's going to be successful, but so far he has. And then I got so many people that would tell me, oh, just wait, it's not going to be bad. And I said, yeah, I hear you. I'm with you. It's not going to end well, but so far it's been okay. And so I just feel like part of the reason that allowed last year's outperformance was that expectations were much lower. Now expectations are very high. Positioning is very offsides. Sentiment is very high. Like, everything is the polar opposite of what it was a year ago. And I just don't see enough positive catalysts for it to push even higher than that. And so my opinion is, when you press the bet is when you have a number of things in your favor. And I feel like there's a number of things going against that favor right now. So it's okay to stay in the bet. I'm not telling everybody to go out and sell all their equities because we're going to have a crash. In fact, I think if we do get a pullback, it's probably one that you buy. But I also don't press the bet when sentiment is at its high and relative strength is at its high and positioning is at its high and, you know, everybody, there's no fear. And, you know, that's, to me, that's not the time to press the bet. So I hope that I get a chance this year to press the bet. In other words, I hope we get a dip that I get to buy, because I do think that over the next couple of years, U.S. equities are going to go a lot higher than people think they are.
Which goes back to the dollar milkshake theory. And if you're joining us just for a random talk about finance and economics, and you don't know who Brent is or what the dollar milkshake theory is, you can definitely learn more about all of that on our channel. We break everything down. So if you're new to all of this, there's a playlist at the top. It's the start here. So we encourage you to catch up with us by doing that first. And then all of the episodes are segmented. The thumbnails are easy to follow. You know, Brent, you talked about the idea of the, you know, kind of potential of equities going higher in the future or in the interim in this year. If there is a pullback, it's not going to be this Armageddon crash, and it might be the dip to buy. You know, speaking of things running hot or running higher and buying dips or perhaps missing dips, what are your thoughts on gold this year? Because that was, you know, something you've been in gold for a long time. So it going higher doesn't harm you, but you definitely were salivating at the opportunity to buy it around 1800. Situation kicked off in Israel, gold fired up to over 2000, pulled back. And now we seem to find new support here above 2000.
Yeah, I think if we get a dip in gold, it's a dip that you buy. And the reason is because I think the scenarios that would cause gold to fall is probably in one in which counterintuitively is a risk off environment. A lot of times people think you buy gold because of risk off. Well, in the initial stages of risk off, gold often falls with everything else. But the response to the falling is what turbocharges gold higher. And so I think if we're going to get these magnificent 7 rate cuts, I think it's because things are getting worse, not because things are getting better. And if we get some kind of a risk off scenario that necessitates these 7 rate cuts, then I think gold is something you buy in that pullback. On the upside, I don't have some wild target to the upside in the short term. You know, I've said many times that I think in the years ahead, gold's going to at least $5,000. I want to own it because, you know, once we essentially the whole dollar milkshake theory is a framework for how a sovereign debt crisis plays out. A sovereign debt crisis leads to people shunning fixed income, getting out of fixed income, getting out of the currencies, the foreign currencies, and getting into real assets. Some of those real assets will be U.S. equities. Some of those real assets will be gold and, you know, other precious metals or land or whatever it is. And so, you know, I want to be in assets that benefit from the rejection of overall fiat currency and sovereign bonds. And then people say, well, why do you think the dollar is going higher? Well, the whole milkshake theory is the dollar going higher versus other fiat currencies. It doesn't necessarily mean it will go higher versus gold. In fact, I've said many, many times that we'll get into a situation where the dollar is rising versus all fiat currencies, and that gold is rising versus all fiat currencies. And that at some point, I don't know when, I'm not smart enough to know the exact timing, I think gold will pull away and be the ultimate winner. So, you know, if you get it, everybody should own gold right now. Again, I think it's okay to have something in your portfolio that isn't necessarily designed to pay off right now today. If it does, great, you own it. But if we get a dip, then I think that would be, I always reserve the right to change my mind because I would have to figure out, well, why did we get the dip? If it's for what I anticipate now, then it would be a buying opportunity. If it's not, if it's due to something else, I would have to revisit it. But I think in the years ahead, we're going to see the rejection of fiat currency. We're going to see governments have to print more money. We're going to see more government stimulus. We're going to see bigger budget deficits around the world. And I think that's a tailwind for gold.
Well, speaking of hard money and buying the rumor, selling the fact, or selling the event, finally, a Bitcoin spot ETF was approved. And that seemed kind of to be arriving not with a thunder, but with a whimper. Any thoughts on, you know, that finally happening and maybe with some of the run-up to that, pretty much just markets buying the rumor and now it's kind of all gassed out?
Yeah, I think maybe a little bit of that. You know, I'm not smart enough to know what Bitcoin does in the next couple of days or next couple of weeks or even couple of months. I don't know, but I would think of Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin's going to take over the world. I don't think it's going to become the next global reserve currency. I don't think central banks are going to start to buy it. But to me, it's probably the purest play on global liquidity. And so if you think about what has happened over the last 4 to 6 months with interest rate hikes around the world kind of being taken off the table, China's done a number of stimulus. The Fed has kind of pivoted and talking about, you know, interest rates coming down. That's happened around other parts of the world as well. And so markets have been liquefied for the last 4 or 5 months. And over that time period, Bitcoin did fantastically. And if you look back throughout, you know, the last 10 or 15 years, typically when there's a lot of global liquidity, Bitcoin does pretty well. And when there's not a lot of global liquidity, Bitcoin doesn't do very good. And so if we got into some kind of a negative scenario this year, I would expect Bitcoin to fall with other risk assets, but I would expect it then to explode higher on, you know, government stimulus or a return to QE or the cutting of interest rates or, you know, however you want to define that. Because I don't think Bitcoin is going away. It doesn't mean that I think it's taking over the world, but I also don't think it's going away. And I think people will always speculate on ways to make more money, right? And I think Bitcoin is a way for people to speculate. And I think, you know, it doesn't make, I'm not a huge Bitcoin advocate, but I'm not a Bitcoin hater either. A lot of people think I'm a Bitcoin hater. I'm more of a hater of a lot of the narratives around Bitcoin than I am about Bitcoin itself.
Awesome. Well, look, first episode of the year, we covered a lot. It was a fairly busy 2 weeks, but I think taking more of the approach of getting your mindset and getting our heads right going into a year, everything is uncertain. No one has a crystal ball. The likelihood, looking at past precedents, is that we've got some volatility ahead of us and that what the market thinks it's pricing in with 7 rate cuts is probably a bit over the top and perhaps we fall somewhere in the middle. But it's let's say relatively been quiet with pretty much bonds, stocks, everything kind of moving sideways. So it's given us a time to ease into the new year, catch our breath, launch, you know, the first episode of season 2. So we appreciate everyone joining us for that. We also appreciate everyone who picked up an Enjoy Cashflow or Dollar Hegemon t-shirt. We had some Christmas presents going out this year. I'll have a link in our show notes where people can grab that. We're going to get Brent one of those as well. And I think that that's probably the best way to wrap this one up. We have a Martin Luther King Day holiday on Monday, so it'll be a short week. And there's not much on the econ calendar, so I don't think we'll be doing a Monday peak of the week, but good chance we bring that segment back as well. As I mentioned, there'll be some new things we'll be introducing here real soon. Brett, before we wrap up the episode, anything else you want to share?
No, I'm really looking forward to this year. I, you know, we said it at the end of the last year, but I'll say it to kick off this year too. You know, really appreciate everybody who comes out and listens to us and interacts with us in the comments and, you know, follows us on Twitter. And, you know, John and I have had a fantastic time doing this show. So it's just a lot of fun for us. And we're glad that you guys are having fun as well. Next week's episode will be coming to you. I'll be in Vancouver, Canada. I think John will still be in Sydney, so assuming he hasn't gotten eaten by a shark on his daily surfing expeditions. But I'll have some some reporting to give you from sunny Canada, hopefully.
Well,
hopefully it's not a blizzard.
Yeah, we try to record these a little earlier. This is late on a Saturday. But speaking of sharks, I had a bit of a run-in with a jellyfish right near my eye. So I was a scary monster on Thursday. So we ended up pushing back.
Ah, you look good.
I'm looking good, man. Well, we appreciate everyone joining us. Join Brent on Twitter, where he's very active, very accessible, using his handle SantiagoAUFund. You can find me on Twitter as well at John Kutzmita. And you can follow this channel on YouTube and on Twitter with the handle Milkshakes Pod. That's it. Season 1 is over. Season 2 is here. Episode 1 of season 2 is now in the books. We'll see everyone real soon.
They are the Magnificent 7.
This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.